That's Les McCann and his magic band with Trinidad, featuring steel pianist Andy Narell. Les is putting a little jazz and fusing it with Trinidad, their little taste of my homeland. This is Lee's Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, December the 13th. And the body of Nelson Mandela lies in state at the Union Buildings in Pretoria for the third and final day. The African National Congress will hold a commemorative ceremony in Mandela's honor at the Waterkloof military base in Pretoria tomorrow. And then on Sunday, the body will be flown to the Eastern Cape for final funeral services in Kunu, his ancestral village. And those services are for Mandela's family, his Abatembu clan, and governmental officials and international dignitaries. And thus officially will come to a close a nation and the world's farewell to a great giant. But of course, the story doesn't stop there. And that gives me a lead into what it is I'm going to be talking about today. A reluctance to tell the whole story. You know, information is power. And the lack of information is understandably and logically the key to powerlessness. And there, you know, it's not that people sit down in a room and they have phone calls and they have conferences and they send around emails to decide what the stories ought to be, i.e. what it is you and I as consumers of information need to know. They automatically know what should constitute our knowledge base, what they should disseminate in the way of information, what we read and see and hear in the way of information. The gatekeepers of news in the United States and in most every country now, because so many countries pattern their information systems after that of the United States, the gatekeepers of news are extensions of a political order and know instinctively what to do. It is no surprise, therefore, that in the coverage, the so-called live coverage, and in subsequent coverage, let's say, of the memorial service, much was made of a handshake between President Obama and President Raul Castro. A handshake. Oh my gosh, look what has happened here. The president has shook the hand of that vile, evil leader of that vile, evil island. My God, what is going to happen next? Of course, it is immaterial, and they don't have the guts to mention the fact that there's a reason for that absence of coverage about what the real issue is, and that is this little island, and I also have criticisms of it, but the facts are the facts. This little island has been of greater use and greater help in the freedom struggles of black people and other people all over the world than the big guys. And it's not just mouth service or lip service, as you would say. Real bodies hit the ground ready to defend other people's freedom. Three hundred thousand 1,000 Cubans served in Angola between 1975 and 1991. How many American troops went to defend Angola's freedom? And that's just one example. Doctors, teachers, all throughout Central and South America and in the Caribbean. A country that does not have unlimited resources as a victim of the most vicious types of sanctions against it, but it feels duty bound to sign on to struggles of freedom. The United States could not. We listened over a 2-day period to President Obama's speech, and I went deliberately, very slowly, to show you what a charade it was. The president knew implicitly that he could not, despite the fact that he got all the support from African Americans and Latinos, who are the base of his political support, he dared not cross the line and suggest that he was actually attending the memorial service of a freedom fighter, and he was in the land, physically in the same land in which a protracted war was being waged. They don't call it a war, they call it apartheid. It's a war. It was a war. And if you have any doubts about whether this apartheid is a whole different thing from war, you better start reading. It's the way they dress things up. And the media is doing the same thing, playing with your minds. Here is an opportunity in modern times to present to people a very clinical analysis of what has transpired in a country that has been repeated all over the world. But here is a seminal topic. You can certainly take a look at Nelson Mandela in the context of the continuum of struggle. You know, they'll have you believe it's all over. They declared it over. It's a new day. Kumbaya, they all got together and sang Kumbaya, and all is well in South Africa, and this lovely gray-haired man who smiles a lot, a very amicable kind of guy, he brought it all to an end. And look, everything is over, and there's peace in the land. They will not tell you that the same process, the same experience, was all over the African continent, all over places where people just wanted to be left alone. European marauders just were out of control. They wanted everything. They wanted your land. They came after the land. They came after everything on it and in it and under it and over it and around it. They wanted it all. Just in the African continent alone. Algeria, France, Angola, Portugal, Benin, France, Botswana, Britain, Burkina Faso, France, Burundi, Belgium, Cameroon, France, Cape Verde, Portugal, Central African Republic, France, Chad, France, Comoros, France, Congo Republic, Belgium, Côte d'Ivoire, France, Djibouti, France, Egypt, Britain, Equatorial Guinea, Spain, Eritrea, Ethiopia, which was the only exception, but that still is up for question. Gabon, France, Gambia, Britain, Ghana, Britain, Guinea, France, Guinea-Bissau, Portugal, Kenya, Britain, Lesotho, Britain, Liberia, the American Colonization Society, America's first attempt at exporting imperialism in the form of colonization in 1847. Libya, Italy, Madagascar, France, Malawi, Britain, Mali, France, Mauritania, France, Mauritius, Britain, Morocco, France, Mozambique, Portugal. Are you following me? Namibia, South Africa, Niger, France, Nigeria, Britain, Rwanda, Belgium, Sao Tome, Portugal, Senegal, France, Seychelles, Britain, Sierra Leone, Britain, Somalia, Britain and Italy, South Africa, Britain, and of course, in the earlier periods, this is just recent, the Dutch East India Company, Sudan, Egypt and Britain, Swaziland, Britain, Tanzania, Britain, Togo, French-administered UN trusteeship, Tunisia, France, Uganda, Britain, Zambia, Britain, Zimbabwe, Britain. That's just Africa. This list just represents the most recent expression of the marauders. They come into an entire continent and wreak havoc. They kill, they maim, they rape, they pillage, they steal, they destroy. And then they present it as re-civilizing these savages. We gave them culture. We gave them structure and order. And in the process of this racist domination of other people's countries and territories, as I said, they go after everything in, on, over, under, and around the land. And that is how they become superpowers. That is how they developed their economies. And that could only be done by developing a political philosophy to justify their savagery. The political philosophy developed in South Africa was this thing called apartheid. A political mythology, so that you are brought to think that this was really a contest of people who just wanted the other folks to have better manners. That it was just about a quarrel over democracy, when in fact this was a centuries-old systematic pogrom, an ethnic cleansing of unimaginable proportions. When I just read you that list, if you add up all of the African lives, and this just goes back to the, I would say, the early 1800s, this is not many, many centuries old. This is just fairly recent, historically speaking. If you add up of all these European powers, they didn't come there to build roads and hospitals and libraries and sewage treatment plants. They came there in all of these countries from A to Z on the African continent, and I haven't gone into South America and Central America and the Caribbean and elsewhere. Just this one continent. I haven't talked about India. I haven't talked about Asia, where the European marauders, completely out of control, completely driven by greed, and with a mindset of, we will kill you, we are coming to get what you have, and we are prepared to kill you for it. We only need those of you who will supply the labor to extract from your land what we need. We don't need anybody else. And they developed this silly, silly word, apartheid. And people are running around using it, not realizing it itself is a nice, as a pristine word, really, suggesting that the issue in South Africa was that some people had manners and some people did not. And all the black folks in South Africa, all they wanted to do was to ask people to be nice and mannerly and fair. And there is a great irony. Our president, our half-African president, standing before other Africans and couldn't find one way to tie himself in. He couldn't tie himself. Divested himself in public of his African identity. Not because he wanted to alone, but because he knew he had to. He didn't talk about that at all. He comes talking all nice and flowery. Because the fact is, he could not address the situation as a statesman. He did not have statesman standing. Comes talking like a friend. He just met Mr. Mandela a blink of an eye ago. It's not like they were deep with each other at all. Found his way to Africa quite late. Years in the fourth year, going into fifth year of his term in office. Well, not surprising. It took him 790 days to meet with blacks in the Congressional Black Caucus. But there he is before the world. I hope people understand how deep this is. Here is a man born in the crucible of black political power in Chicago. Black people took him under their wings and showed him how to do things, showed him the possibility of a political career, taught him what it is he needed to know. And he mined the black vote as the basis of his political legitimacy and ambition. And it worked. He called it, he didn't even understand it. That, Mr. President, was Ubuntu. Black folks voted for you in the numbers that they voted for you. Latinos voted for you in the numbers that they voted for you because of Ubuntu. You didn't even get it. They said, well, look, we take a shot. Surely something good will come out of this. And into office he goes. They make it possible for him to rise at meteoric speed to the very top. And he stands there for the whole world to see as a self emasculated man, speaking not as a statesman and invoking the false cadence of a good preacher. starts talking like he's at the church. The church puts on his church talk. He couldn't say a thing as a statesman. He's terrified. Terrified. Does not want to actually express what went on in South Africa, because he and the other three presidents sitting right behind him know the truth. While black people were suffering all over the continent, as I have pointed out to you, this long list that I pointed out to, the U.S. sided with the wrong folks. They sided with the marauders. They aided and abetted genocide and called it foreign policy. They said, you know, we can't support that. South Africa is the ANC is a communist organization. It's a communist organization. So they were prepared, because they're so anti-communist, because communism is the axis of evil. They're prepared to let black folks die, let them bleed in the streets, let them bleed on the roads, let them bleed to death. Let their houses be shot up. Let them just simply disappear in this carnival of carnage. Racist carnage. Supporting the terrorist state. Because that's what black folks had been living through all over Africa. Whether it was Britain or Belgium or France or Portugal. It was under terrorist conditions that folks had been living. The entire continent. Our president can't say boo. Can't say diddly. And he was brought into power by a black political base. Irony of ironies. But he has been properly schooled. And in his schooling, his political schooling, the formula is, you get black political support, but you answer to the white political powers. Their agenda is number one. Ironic, isn't it? It was a sad day to see the president stand up there before the microphone and pretend that what he was saying is so deep. And then the media following through with what a passionate speech it was. It was hollow. And it was telling. And the media now follow through on that because they understand flowery stuff when they hear it. But they don't when it comes to black folks. You know, this president, they like the fact that he goes into his preacher mode when he's talking to black folks. he talks like a preacher. He studies the cadence of Martin Luther King someplace in the basement in the White House, and then gets up and delivers a speech written clearly by somebody who does not understand black culture. But anyway, he makes his speech and the media follow up with gratuitous analysis. And not in one instance did I hear the media talk about the history of what really has happened in South Africa. and how symbolic it was in the black world of struggle. I'm talking about now a continent-wide history of struggle against the same thing, European marauders holding these countries hostage for centuries, and in the modern days with the complicity of the so-called superpowers and most superpowers of the world, the U.S., Britain, France, and the others trailing behind them. They all agree black people are very little value. And then comes the symbol, the icon, Mandela, the icon has fallen, finally. So what they do is they give him a sweet goodbye, a loving kind of disregard. They minimize his importance. They reduce his place in history to just being the guy who was fighting apartheid, went to Robben Island, into jail for 27 years, breaking rocks at hard labor, and had such a strong soul. And the president himself endorses this super simplistic view that while in jail, and they do the same thing for all the black folks, you know, certainly in jail, this is where they fortified themselves and came true to their real characters, having had all that time to ponder their errant ways. That is to say, jail was good for the likes of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela. It was a good thing. It was a rite of passage, because in that period, you know, with all that time to contemplate, it was where Martin Luther King had time to write books and reflect. It was where Malcolm X had time to change the nature of his base character and come out a far more a wiser man. And here, in the case of Nelson Mandela, 27 years gave him character. You see, because he didn't have any. And they create this myth, and they propagate this myth, and people eat it up. Here's your hero. The president is saying in the eulogy how imperfect he was in so many ways, but really he was basically a nice guy in the end. That's how a half African president. And we eat this up. And the so-called progressive media, these are the people who have had their kumbaya moment in the 60s. You know, they'll tell you how they marched against the war in Vietnam, and they marched for women's rights, and they marched for this, and they marched for that, and they're not like those conservative folks over there. They're on the other side of the aisle. The same people in media are selling the same story. Why? Because they regard as a threat, and this is a universal thing, and some of people who consider themselves progressive will have to admit it's true. There is a fear about people knowing who they are. And there is, on the flip side of that, no matter how progressive, there is a sense of satisfaction, of supremacy. They're still supremacists. You become real and whole only when we let you. Only when we decide. And, of course, that will never happen. Because in the end, they are the ones who determine what you know, what you see, what you read. They control information. You watch CNN, for example, as I did during the coverage of these events. On the inside, where the heavy thinking is being done about Mandela, there's no black person around. All right? Chris Cuomo is there as if he knows anything about South Africa, and Gloria Vanderbilt's son, what's his name? Anderson Cooper and other people are there. Four people supposedly anchoring this major historic event. And among all four of them, what they really know is minuscule. Some intern's job is to go find some facts that would get them through a good half hour of sounding reasonably intelligent. The heavy intellectual work is on the inside, where these four whites are. Send the black folks outside of the stadium in the rain to cover the all-important news of people coming and going to the stadium where the memorial service is being held. They took charge of it. You watch the coverage. You read the coverage. You're not seeing any black person in charge of letting you know what you need to know about the situation. Not at all. When you saw a black face, it was, well, what did Nelson Mandela mean to you? kind of thing. They're not discussing who was in the trenches in this war that is euphemistically called apartheid. They're not interested in reordering history, reshaping history, telling you the truth, telling you the whole truth. It will never happen. To this day, well, they concede, they'll talk about Martin Luther King. You know, they could talk about him, but only in the context now of dreaming. He's a dreamer, so they got that fixed permanently, etched in the mind of the nation and the world. Martin Luther King equals the dreamer. Malcolm X, well, he was a radical guy, so he is not to be given too much sway. Just don't give him too much room, except that he changed his mind about white people being devils and moved to, quote, a more orthodox form of Islam and was humanized by a long stint in jail. That's what we need to know about Malcolm X. And now, Nelson Mandela is a nice old man who smiles a lot and basically brought the country to independence after a long period called apartheid. You believe that? Pay attention. This is how we are conditioned as a society. I don't mean only black folks are affected. Everybody is affected because this process is meant to shape our minds. We are all conditioned to believe and think the same thing. And the media is performing its function, an extension of governmental and other political imperatives that require that if not for real, at least, if not in actual practice, but at least in such a way that it permeates all of society. In philosophy, we get it. We start thinking alike. For African Americans, the idea is to separate you from your true self, your true power, your true accomplishments, your true origins, your true capacities. For whites, it is to reinforce your supremacies in so many different areas. But it certainly was a learning moment. As I say, a teachable moment, as President Obama would say. A teachable moment. I'll take a break and come back to your thoughts right after some messages about great programs right here at PRN.FM. You'll be calling in at 888-874-4888. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Your calls and comments, observations, whatever, at 888-874-4888. I'm talking about this period, observing the media follow through on what it considers to be its primary function, which is to be an extension of controls, social and political controls, in the face of what is a clear mandate to provide proper context for this particular historic event being the death of a leader of in the continuum of struggle in this long war in South Africa, that they still insist on whitewashing things and twisting the coverage, and in fact, just simply omitting, acts of omission and acts of commission going on. Hello, you're on the air, Sarah, from Dallas.
Greetings to you, Eutrice, and hello. Greetings to the... Yes, ma'am. Am I on?
Yes, indeedy.
Yes, Eutrice. First of all, let me say greetings to you and the PRN audience, and fantastic show as usual, and I start off by wishing you an enjoyable weekend as much as you can. Enjoy this weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
You keep ma'aming me. I'm 22. I keep telling you that.
Well, you
no matter how old and decrepit I look, I am 22 years old.
Well, ma'am, you are still older than me. It's just a habit that my parents, God rest their soul, they would be beating me with a stick if I was to slip from it. But this... what you're saying, Eutrice, you have been on point all of this week, and it's been a fantastic show. People who don't have this in their archives, you need to save this show. You need to go back through, and this is what you call the power of analysis and the power of comprehension, of reading with comprehension, because a lot of us, we read, but we don't have comprehension when we read. And these shows that you have done in the breaking down of the speeches and going it step by step, for those of us who forgot that part of our elementary school learning, it will help to reinforce that. Yes, ma'am, you are welcome. What this has shown us, Eutrice, unfortunately, in our society, we don't like the truth. To quote that line from the Jack Nicholson movie, you want the truth, you can't handle the truth. And unfortunately, with us as black people and with the European-dominant society here, they have fostered this falsification and this sense of fantasy and myth that have been pushed upon us, where they don't want the raw, unadulterated truth to be shown to them. They don't like it. And we go through it all the time. We go through all this mythification with religions and everything else, where we like to mythicize people, and we don't like to see them in all their fallacies and whatever might be wrong with them. We don't like to see the person as they are. We know the media was going to try and put their spin, because they'd already done it before. They'd already started with this man talking about this peace and this truth and reconciliation, how he forgave his jailers. He invited them to come to his inauguration. He was this nice old man and all this stuff. But you, Trees, as I said over and over again, I can forgive a person if you did something to me. And you come up to me and you ask me, said, I'm so sorry, I did this wrong, and you're genuine in your being sorrowful. I can forgive what you did to me, but that don't mean to say I'm going to forget it or I'm going to move on, because human nature tells me that if you did something atrocious to me, as for instance, as in the slaughtering, the killing of me and my people, I cannot forgive you that, because that is not up to me to do that, Eutrice. That is up to the ancestors who departed this world in such a vicious way. They have to be the one to forgive. You cannot come to me and ask me to do that. Which is why in the Jewish cause, they make it a point of they're going to avenge what you did to their people. They are not looking for forgiveness. No one is asking them to forgive what the Nazis and the other people do. They don't care how old you are. You have to pay for your crimes. And I find it very offensive that a lot of people are trying to call in and saying that we need to be like Dr. King and we need to be forced. Dr. King was in a different era, operating under a different time and place of things.
Are you there? Oh, no. We just lost Sarah? I'm so sorry, Sarah. Please try and call back. It looked like you got cut off or your phone just failed there for a minute. And you were on a roll. Are you there? No. Okay. DX from Los Angeles. How are you?
Hello, Eutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I'll just continue on with what Sarah was saying. I kind of, you know, agree with her, but the thing that they miss out on is Dr. King, at the last couple of years of his life, was becoming very, very impatient with the powers that be. He was beginning to take a turn, you know. Mm-hmm. Not saying that he would have fully endorsed any kind of violent thing or anything, but he started to realize that he wasn't getting very far with the tactics he was employing. And so they leave that last couple of years of his life out. And that's, you know, that's what they do. See, they have a vested interest in defanging these people, making them very affable and very calm and, you know, and very non-critical of their whole situation, so that we don't get the feeling that any kind of movement that challenges the power structure can be successful, you know. And like you were saying with Malcolm X, he believed in any means necessary. That means if we have to get violent with you because you're being violent, we will, you know. And if it doesn't come to that, that's fine too. Whatever we have to do, but they leave that part, you know, out, and they or either they make him seem to be like he was just a troublemaker, and then he spent time in jail, and he
Oh yes, we know that. What I was trying to say though is that people need to understand. I just rattled off an entire nation. All right?
Right,
an entire nation come under siege persistently over centuries by
right.
marauders. This was a continent at
a
war,
whole,
just trying
continent.
To defend itself
right.
to be
right.
to hold on to its own land. And
mm-hmm.
this notion that apartheid, it was an inconvenient thing, and it was you know, people just not behaving right. It's never described. This is a war. This was a war.
Right. Well, the whole period of the 60s, most of that has to be wiped from my memories. You know that, right? Because it was like a worldwide movement, especially of black people, trying to attain their freedom and or rights. And Nelson Mandela was a part of that, along with Dr. King, and Malcolm X and the Black Panthers and all that. So we have to be, that has to be erased from our memory, that right there, so that it never happens again.
Well, I want to thank you for your call. Thanks so much, Dex. Sarah, are you back?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay, your phone just quit on us there for a minute.
Yes, ma'am. I guess the NSA is probably not liking the line this conversation is taking.
Coming up next week, I have something on the NSA coming up next week. But go ahead,
yes,
finish
ma'am.
Your thought.
Here's what I'd like to suggest to you, Ms. Lee. Could you try and get Dr. Frank B. Wilderson III? He wrote a very beautiful memoir about his time on the ANC. He was one of two Americans who were a part of the ANC before Madiba was released from imprisonment. And he would make a fantastic guest to get his points and his views because he has wrote a lot of books. You have one out there called Incognito, amongst other things, that he has talked about the apartheid movement and what went on in South in Azania. So he would be a fantastic guest for you to have to
Thank you. And thanks for calling back.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Is Clara with us? No. Jesse, you're on the air.
Yeah. Well, hello.
Hello.
I got an idea saying that if Mr. Obama was to be as strong as we want him to be, he would have to go underground as Mandela had to. So I figured the best way to try to deal with, you know, if you're a drug dealer, I used to deal drugs. You didn't want to do it. I had to do it to put food on the table. So to try to confront somebody doing something they don't want to do is pretty tough. So the best way to do it is try to change them to a better way to do it. So I would say, okay, look, you profit from our oppression. I could give you a better way to profit from not oppressing. So let's, you know, share this. So that's the basic concept. These guys are used to controlling things. So we have to give them a better idea that they control is no good. They doing it backwards, and there's a better way to make money. So the better way to make money.
Well, I want to ask you that question.
The better way to make money.
No, you made a statement that you had to deal drugs in order to put food on the table. Is that in fact a legitimate explanation?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have no choice, what choice do you have? I mean, that's the way life is sometimes. So if you're going to change somebody, what's the old stories you used to see? The medicine man is treating a sick child in the tribe, and then the white man comes there with his better medicine, and then everybody starts respecting the white man. So this, in other words, if we're going to get the respect of the 1%, not that we need it, but the deal power respects power, we're going to have to come up with an idea that is better than getting 100 people come together to in a cooperation to make money with, I would say, if you have a cooperative, people voluntarily working together and sharing what they work for, better than one guy controlling 100 people competing with slavery or trying to control them by force or police state or whatever, because that kind of control makes you think these people are playing God. And
do you still do
knows
drugs?
Where that end up.
Do you still, are you still dealing drugs?
No.
What made you stop?
Well, I got a job. I got a living. This was way back in the late 60s, middle 60s, and early 70s when there was no work. And then, you know, it was just the way it was. So then work started picking up. I would do anything to get work to do it. A lot of my friends are dead or gone or in jail. So, you know, I didn't want to go that way. So, you know. But this is basically it. If you're going to stop these people from threatening us, destroying the world or whatever, a police state, we got to let them know this is not the road. I mean, you share it with us, you don't have to worry about taking it with you. You know? I mean, because if I got to sleep with both my eyes open at night worrying about somebody robbing me, worrying about the police, and somebody could come up and say, look, hey, this is a better idea, Jesse. Let's work together, and you could put food on the table, and you could close both your eyes at night. So, you know, I mean, Obama, he could pretty much offer something, but look at the Fed. The Fed is printing money, and they know it's illegal, but they say they need to stop, but they can't stop, because if they stop, the system's going to collapse. So the only way they could get around that is by saying, look, let the Fed print the money. Who's going to back it? You ain't getting no more bailouts. The bailout, these are too big to fail. So, look, we back it. The people will back it when we get a bailout. Obama could say something like that. That could be sympathizing with them. But, okay, what you going to do with the people, you know, who's really, really bad? Well, hey, let the system judge them for it. If I was a bad drug dealer, I did some horrible things. If I'm man enough, I'd be responsible for it. So, but if I could give my kids and everybody else a better life, I'd be no problem. I pay the price.
Well, you know, there is a particular argument on the flip side of that, too, is that you're not the only one in such a scenario paying the price. The people who are the customers also pay a price. The people in the community who are preyed upon by those people who feel compelled they have to do things outside the norm to get the money to support their habit. You know, it's a vicious cycle. Nobody wins.
Yeah, well, you have to set an example for them. Because if you're the lead guy who's pretty much started it all, like Escobar in Colombia, no sooner than they
started it all. I mean, come on now. I mean, we're going to have another discussion on this another day. It's a very important discussion. But I'm out of time.
Okay.
Unfortunately, but I want to thank you, though, for your contribution today, and we'll come back to your discussion. It's a very important discussion because it's a reality in the community as well. Thank you so much, Jesse,
thank
for
you.
Calling.
Thanks.
We've come to the end of our program today, and I hope that, you know, we have taken a better look, a more comprehensive look at these things and how they seem so innocuous. They don't seem to be, in fact, they seem to be just right. I mean, perfect. They're doing their job. They're telling us they're reporting, they're people reporting, and we have a different view of this event when we begin to look much closer. And we see the intent of it, which is, of course, the whole point of understanding what it is that we are experiencing in this moment. Thanks so much for joining me here today and for joining me every day. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Bye-bye.